Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. With me today is somebody I could say an old friend, not so old in years, but just we've known each other a while. Matt Dunn is on the phone. He's the founder and executive director of Center on Rural Innovation. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Pat. Great to be on.
Yes, great to hear your voice. I'm sorry we couldn't do it in person, but you have a darn good reason why you're not here. Could you tell people what you're up to after the show?
Well, of course, this is Election Day, Democracy Day in Vermont and the rest of the country, and I'm a JP. And so with it, being a justice of the peace is a responsibility to work the polls in an important election like this. One should not shirk those duties or show up late. So I am in my office, which is directly across the triangle from Damon Hall in Heartland, Vermont, and I'll be heading over there after we talk.
Well, thank you for your service. That's great. I voted early, and I really am sorry I did, because I like the excitement of going on Election Day and seeing the people and voting. So I may not be doing that again in the years to come. Good way to catch up on gossip in town, too. It's a good thing.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the fun parts about
exactly.
It gets slow in the afternoon, catch up on everything.
There you go. I also miss town meeting like we used to have it, with lunch provided by the fire department, and you could really hang around. But there we go. Things change. Matt, could you tell our viewers a little about your background? You certainly have an interesting one, that's for sure.
Sure, and Pat, you were there for the early parts of my career.
Yes, I was.
So I grew up here in Heartland, and went off to college and came back and was elected to the legislature the same year I graduated, by a community that really brought me up. I lost my father when I was young, and you don't appreciate small town Vermont in a meaningful way until something like that happens, and it just makes such an amazing difference. And that same community that was there for my family decided that I should go and represent them in Montpelier. And so started, a career in public service outside of the part-time legislature, was in technology. So was in a leadership position at a software company based in Wilder, Vermont, I helped to grow over a period of time. I then served in the Clinton administration and Bush administration as the head of AmeriCorps Vista, building out an incredible community of change agents out there, making a difference in local communities all over the country. Came back, served two terms in the state Senate while working at Dartmouth College, and then was recruited by Google to head up their community affairs program and really create it from scratch. Starting with data center communities across rural America, then the offices, and then Google Fiber, international offices, eventually other projects like Kite Wind and drones and other kinds of things. Then I came back in 2016 to the political realm. I never left Vermont, as I think we've discussed before.
Right.
I refused to move when people recruited me, and so they let me open an office in White River Junction, which is still there today.
Is it really cool?
Google employers. Oh yeah, it's right there. And I tried to get back into politics in 2016, and the way that politics works is sometimes it's your time and sometimes it's not, and it was not. And so as I was trying to figure out what way can I make a difference in the world, it came back to this through line in my life, which was I'm really passionate about empowering rural communities through progressive economic development strategies. And that's what I did in the legislature. That's what I did at AmeriCorps Vista. That's what I really did at Google. And having seen the massive economic divide that had emerged since the 2008 recession between rural and urban areas, I felt that's where I should focus my time, and that's when we launched the Center on Rural Innovation.
That's great. What a great background, and thank you very much. This is quite amazing. We missed the story about my cousin coming up to help you from Virginia.
What? It's true. That was great.
And, wasn't that funny?
It was an incredible part of that campaign team, and appreciated you referring just an extraordinary young person who's gone on to do really amazing things as well.
Just to let people know, this is a Vermont story because Matt and I are not with the same party, and my cousin did some research and heard about Matt and thought he was really an up-and-comer and wanted to help him in his campaign. I was Governor Scott's – I was his campaign manager for his first run at lieutenant governor, which we were successful at. And we would run into Matt and my cousin all over – and parades and all over. So it was really – I think it was fun. It just, we had a lot of pictures of us all together. It was good memories back then. So, and he is, thank you for that. He's a very nice young man out in California now. Terrible assignment, but there you go. Anyway, so you talked about the Center on Rural Innovation that you founded in 2016, and the definition of it, which I'm going to read because it kind of boggles my mind a little. An organization that seeks to create a scalable model for economic development across rural America. Could you talk about what that all means? And especially, you really are working across America.
Yeah. So the divide that emerged between rural and urban areas since the 2008 recession was really unprecedented in 100 years. There was just a very different recovery from that economic shock. Urban places came roaring back, rural places not so much. So even in the month before COVID hit, not even half of all rural counties had gotten back to their pre-2008 levels. COVID hit and everyone fell, rural fell harder, and the recovery from that has also been much harder in rural communities than in urban places. And if you look at the data, it really came down to three drivers. One was automation, and the second was globalization empowered by technology advances that allowed for working all over the world rather than just in lower-cost rural labor markets. And the third was the decline of entrepreneurship for the 30 years prior to 2008 in rural America. That meant that when an economic shock like that happened, there wasn't the farm team of new businesses that could come in and bring new approaches to delivering goods and services to rural places. Bring all those together, and you really had a recipe for a mess. And oddly, it wasn't an economic decline that got a lot of media attention for a while. You would hear stories about some of the effects of that, like newspapers shutting down because there wasn't the market for advertising, or the hospitals starting to close because the payer mixes got harder and harder for hospitals to make it, or even the deaths of despair, whether it was suicide or opioid overdoses. These were all things that happened at the same time as the economic decline, but it just wasn't in our focus. And so we decided that an approach to solving this could be to hit it head on, to figure out how to build tech economies in rural places. And that's what we set out to do. And we started in a very place-based kind of way. We started our work in Springfield, Vermont, which is an extraordinary community with an amazing past, but had hit real economic hard times when for all intents and purposes, the machine tool industry left after they had, benefited from that very specific type of industry for, many, many decades. And so we started our work there, but we knew if we were just going to tackle one community at a time, it would take a very long time to make a dent in the economic opportunity gap that we're seeing across the country. So tapping into the work that I had done at AmeriCorps Vista and even at Google, looked to find ways that we could work with local communities and local community leaders to to give them the tools and the strategy and connect them to the resources so that they could build a tech economy leveraging the context of their own community. Because it's going to be different in Springfield than it is in Rutland than it is in Platteville, Wisconsin. And with the support of the Economic Development Administration, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Commerce, we started working outside of Vermont in communities in different regions of the state. We really refined that technical assistance approach that could help empower communities through that assessment strategy and securing funding to stand up tech accelerators. And we then created a network, a community of those leaders that could come together and share their own best practices to be successful as a collaborative. And in many cases, you know, today they get a lot more from each other than our brilliant ideas from some central organization. And so that network piece is critical both for sharing best practices, but also to get a critical mass, because one small rural innovation hub is going to struggle to get enough deal flow, enough new startups to attract national investors into to look at the companies in that area. But if you get 20 or 30 or 40 of those communities, all with their own small tech accelerators, you can actually get network value and a critical mass that can attract the attention of those important investors.
Wow. That is just some initiative. I am very impressed. Matt, we've got a caller. Fred from Newberry is calling in to ask you a question. Fred, go ahead.
Morning.
I know. Morning.
I think there's a real problem with rural communities as far as economic growth is concerned. And that's two reasons or three reasons or maybe even four. First of all, in order to be efficient in manufacturing, you have to have economies of scale. And in places like the Northeast, you just don't have enough land area to do this. I mean, because the topography of the land is not suitable to have a large manufacturing company. You have to be a small one, and they can't get economies of scale. And if you were to spread small ones out all over the place, that in itself would cause more expense.
Thank you for your question, Fred. Well, that was sort of an interesting question, Matt, about the economy of scale, and that sort of fits in with some of the other questions I was going to ask you about. How do you find these towns, and what do they need to offer to allow you to start working with them?
Sure. One quick thing I would note with the caller is that as much as economies of scale are a real thing and the ability of a community someplace else to take up an entire square mile with a facility for a data center or for a manufacturing plant does set it apart, but these days it's also about how automated you can make your manufacturing facility. And the real revolution that's happening now with, robotic CNC makers all the way through to there's a relatively new invention in Vermont, which is a robotic cheese flipper, where someone realized that flipping cheese is a really, really mundane task, but it's necessary for doing cheese. And if you had a robot that could do it in an automated way, you could actually have a much higher ceiling in a place where, cheese is being cured. And it's one of those kinds of things that you don't really think about. You're like, oh, that would be great to solve that. But it means that facility can be more efficient. It also means fewer jobs. And that's the thing that we're seeing all across the country is that move to automation, which means that manufacturing anywhere can be more efficient, but it also isn't going to employ as many people. And so we need to make sure, and this is our focus, that rural people are actually the ones who can be inventing and creating those new automation tools. rather than just being impacted by them in traditional rural industries. But when we go and we look for communities, in the first wave, we believe that communities that are going to be successful need to have at least some critical mass of population. So we look for places that are in micropolitan communities. That's a census designation, which is usually a community between 5 and 50,000 in population that isn't a suburb. And there's a nice list of those at the U.S. Department of Census. And then we also look for having solved, the broadband problem, so that they've got at least decent broadband in their area, because it's hard to do tech innovation if you don't have that fundamental piece. And then the final thing that we tend to look for, although it's not a requirement, is a four-year college or university campus within a 30 to 40-minute drive. Those entities provide talent, both in terms of students, faculty, also faculty spouses that have a potential to really drive these new economy jobs.
That's great. My head just sort of bouncing up and down when you mentioned colleges, of course, because that's where I think the young entrepreneurs are coming from. They're open to ideas, and that's a real must to have colleges, which we have here in Vermont. I have a really probably under the category of not such a bright question, but could you define the term rural America? What makes an area rural?
Sure. Happy to do so. We actually just published a paper on this because there is so many definitions, even within the federal government, that affect funding decisions. And so different agencies have taken different approaches to defining rural. Some do it at the county level, which is useful since in much of the country, not so much in New England, but in most of the country, counties are really the dominant geographic designation. Others use census tracts, and some use things like place, which is more like your sort of zip code area. And those definitions can vary a lot, but I would say the through line is the amount of density of population in a particular region. So you can have some definitions like what the EDA uses, which says any place with any density doesn't count, and so they really are only looking at very sparsely dense areas, all the way through to the way that the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services define it, or census does with these metro or non-metro census areas. And we really lean on those definitions. So looking at the non-metro areas as defined by micropolitan communities that have a critical mass, like a Rutland or a Springfield. But I don't think anyone would really say that's a rural place, unless you live in a very small town, in which case you think Rutland's the big city. But we use that for our definitions. There are some other nuances, like out in California and New Mexico and Arizona, where the counties are just enormous. Like, they go all the way across California. And we use other things like commute analysis to show where a rural community is its own center of economic gravity, because people are not commuting 4 hours each way to work. They usually have a place of, 10, 20, 30,000 people that are clustered together, have a real downtown, and that can be the center of activity for a tech economy.
That's great. It wasn't such a doofy question, was it? Got too many definitions. Because I was thinking about that. I said, because they think we're a rural state. And yet, like you just said, we would call Rutland a city. So depends on where you're coming from, I guess.
Exactly.
You also talked that word broadband. I think we're still struggling with the last mile here in Vermont. I'm sure these people welcome you with open arms in these rural towns. And broadband must play such an important role in what you're trying to do.
It's absolutely true. And we actually have a team in our collaborating organization, Rural Innovation Strategies, that works that helps with pre-development, helps with states to determine strategies for being able to get that high-speed internet to the last mile. And the good news is that, you know, hope is here. The infrastructure bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, had, you know, $42 billion to actually bring high-speed internet to the last mile of every community in the United States. And if that's used well in public-private partnerships so that it's not, you know, a completely subsidized network, but the private or nonprofit internet service providers or even cooperative electric companies can bring some additional capital to the table, we can solve the broadband problem in our country. It's no longer a cost factor because the government, I think in the wake of COVID, where it was clear that broadband was no longer a luxury, but as important as having an electrical connection to your house, actually funded it and said, we're going to put our money where our mouth is and make it happen. So it's going to take, you know, 4, 5, maybe 6 years for that to get deployed. And, you know, rural electrification didn't happen overnight either. But there is a real possibility now that every home in the country, certainly in the continental U.S., should be connected with high-speed internet that will be able to grow in its speed in the decades to come to be able to keep up with evolving technology.
Sounds exciting. Any word like Vermont in there? Like for our reaching our last
absolutely.
Mile, are we getting there?
Oh, yeah. No, it's very exciting because Vermont, in a bipartisan way, worked really hard to lay the groundwork to do this kind of large deployment, including, you know, experimenting with different ways of doing it. You know, organizations like EC Fiber or even, you know, Vermont Telephone Company down in Springfield, using resources, both community raised as well as state and federal resources to show that it's possible, and then to do a lot of planning and making sure that there was the regulatory environment to allow for that kind of deployment to happen quickly. And unfortunately, in many states, there are all kinds of regulations to slow it down, protect the incumbents who might be providing lousy broadband right now. Vermont really addressed those in a pretty comprehensive way. So the money is flowing into the state very quickly. You know, Christine Holquist was the governor's appointee to manage the distribution of those funds and is, you know, doing so as quickly as possible while still making sure it's done responsibly.
Well, but Matt, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I hear music in the background, which means we've got to take another break. So this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDV, and we'll be right back with Matt Dunn. Hang in.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Hi there, it's Pat McDonald back with you with Vermont Viewpoint. And joining me today is Matt Dunn, who is founder and executive director of the Center on Rural Innovation. Thanks for hanging in there, Matt. You ended the segment with talking about Christine Holquist and the work that she's doing to expand broadband here in Vermont.
Yeah, no, it's just, it is an exciting moment in Vermont since we've been talking about it for a long time and made very small incremental progress, but all along was doing the work to make sure that when, you know, the federal government woke up and said this is a national priority, we'd be able to take advantage of it. And as a result, you know, tens of millions of dollars are now flowing to the state to allow for broadband to be, you know, put up. And that includes places like EC Fiber, which is an interesting public-private partnership, all the way through to Waitsfield Telecom expanding into Addison County and Consolidated Communication building high-speed broadband in the southern tier in Windham and Bennington County. So it's happening. I don't think it can happen fast enough for folks who have been suffering with very, very poor internet for a while, but it is on its way.
Well, it is frustrating because my daughter lives in Maine, and we summer in Maine. And when we go to visit her from here, it's a 3.5-hour ride. There's about a 2-hour block where we have no coverage at all. And we'd like to see that change, just because I don't like riding around for 2 hours without being able to contact anybody. But I'm glad that that we're working on it. That's exciting.
Yeah, and self-service is a separate issue and a separate piece than actually making sure that there is broadband every home. But if you have fiber on the poles, the ability to actually provide small cell distribution of for cell service becomes much, much easier.
Interesting.
So it's critical infrastructure in a variety of ways and should allow for cell coverage to improve along with it.
Great. Thank you. I didn't know that. That's a new information for me, so thank you. So we talked about COVID, and I think it was, let's check the dates, about 3 years after you started, Corey, COVID struck. And you did some work for your communities, for the state. Could you talk a little bit about the index you put together for us?
Sure. So, you know, I think just like everyone, as the pandemic hit and it settled in that it was going to be something completely out of the ordinary, we decided to figure out how could we be most helpful? What is the unique set of data and information that we had had and we had built over a period of time that could make a difference in the response to COVID? And so we did a couple different things. One is we already had a pretty solid data set of where broadband was and was not, and we helped communities understand by school district where they were going to have gaps that they'd have to figure out ways to solve, either with hotspots or other kinds of temporary mechanisms to help people get online. The second was helping states understand where their hospitals would likely to be susceptible to surges. And in rural places, you know, a small surge when you only have a small staff to begin with can have a big impact. And so we did some analysis that allowed for states to plan for those scenarios when there could have been surges in COVID, and how to think about staffing to make sure that that wouldn't become an overwhelming event. And then the third was taking a look at the industry sectors and employment sectors in the state and say, all right, which of these are going to be most affected by COVID, and what should the state be thinking about in terms of addressing those vulnerabilities? And if you are a state that's going to be dependent on tourism, and out of the abundance of caution, the governor decides to shut down the borders of the state and not let folks in, you're going to see an impact. And that is important for legislators and for the administration and for economic development entities, whether it's the RDCs around the state or the chambers, to see a little bit around the corner of what's coming and what to be ready to address. And it also can help in some forward-looking ways, because I hate to say it, I don't think this is the last of these kinds of pandemics, or at least we should be thinking about it rather than only dealing with it when it's a crisis. And so thinking about the economic diversification in a state is good economics in general, but also helps with resilience. And so the type of analysis we did about how susceptible a state is to a pandemic creating economic disruptions can also help in guiding where do we want to go, what kind of jobs do we want to have, and how do we have the infrastructure to allow people to do things like work from home when coming together puts people at risk.
Well, Dave, I think COVID has given us a few lessons here about maybe how to teach differently for schools, virtual meetings. I don't remember actually being in a meeting face to face in quite a while. It's all by Teams or Zoom. And I think workers, particularly I would think in rural areas, if they've got the infrastructure, that they could work at home instead of traveling all sorts of miles to get to work.
COVID has fundamentally changed how we look at work and how we look at place. And that has the potential to help rural places a lot, because if you no longer are told you've got to move to this place, if folks are more free to what I was, you know, able to do with Google, which was, I think, pure luck, but to say I want that job with that aspirational company, but I want to stay in the place that I love, that's much more of a possibility today, because people's, you know, look at where people work has just fundamentally changed. Now, I will say that, Zoomtown is not community. And there is a lot of benefit for people who are working in different sectors or in the same company to come together, to be able to have those virtuous collisions and conversations that take place in a working environment. But that can be a co-work space or a traditional type of office. It doesn't have to be every day, and it can mean that you have a get-together once a month to make sure that that kind of work happens. All of those approaches and strategies are now on the table, and frankly, leaders of organizations, large and small, are evaluating what's the best way to give people the flexibility that they want and allow them to be the most productive while still allowing for that community to emerge where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
I totally agree. A friend of mine who was working remotely for years changed jobs, and she actually went into an office, and she was thrilled that she saw people at the water cooler, that the community aspect of it is so critical, but like you said, maybe not every day. And I also hear that productivity in many companies has increased because of the work-at-home approach. So who knows what we're looking at going forward. And Matt, you said, I was reading some stuff before the interview, you were quoted as saying, you've got to maximize the potential of the workforce. And that's a great recipe to me for job creation. And we could certainly find the workforce in Vermont. I don't know if other states are having the same problem we are about people working. I know we summered in Maine, and you see help wanted signs all over the place, but the workforce is it. You've got to have the workforce. So what are you doing to kind of focus in on the people aspect of jobs?
Yeah, so there's two sides to building a tech economy. One is, the demand side is helping to facilitate rural tech entrepreneurs to be able to bring their idea to market, to get the investment to be able to grow it, and to make it a reality without having to move to Kendall Square, Cambridge, or to San Francisco. And we're seeing more and more of that happen in rural places, and we feel that that's got to continue to accelerate. But the other side is the supply of tech talent. And what has been proven, mostly in cities, is that individuals who have non-traditional education backgrounds can learn how to code and be a part of that technology creation. It's just a different kind of thinking and approach, and it's not limited to folks who go off and get PhDs. It's individuals who think in systems and like solving problems. So what we are involved in is helping to figure out what of those kinds of programs, like the Burlington Code Academy is a local example, or offerings from Vermont Community College or VTC could be integrated into efforts to allow folks who have been perhaps in the workforce for a little while but are really underemployed, are not getting paid what they should, given their potential, to see the segment of those that would really take to these kind of technology jobs can get that training and then to be able to be placed. And sometimes that placement is with, you know, new startups. But right now, there are thousands and thousands of technology jobs in non-tech companies and organizations that are either going unfilled or they're going and hiring folks out of, you know, Brooklyn and San Francisco to do those jobs when, in fact, they could find those people right here in Vermont. Mm. So we're doing some work to try to bridge that gap to ensure that employers know, yes, you can find cybersecurity folks right here in Vermont coming out of excellent programs at Norwich University or UVM or Champlain College, and you can actually build that workforce while we're also helping tech entrepreneurs to be able to grow their companies and create that long-term wealth.
That's great. Matt, you have a CORI, which is, of course, the initials of your firm, CORI Innovation Fund. Could you talk about that and what its purpose is, and where does all that funding come from?
Happy to. One of the things that we heard loud and clear from our communities that were, you know, working really hard to stand up tech accelerator programs to allow entrepreneurs to bring their ideas to market was that investors, typical venture or seed investors, just don't look in rural places. Hmm. They keep looking in the same urban locations that they've always looked in. And so we felt that as a national organization, we had the opportunity to prove that there were unbelievable investment opportunities in rural places. So we received a grant from the Economic Development Administration to do the legwork, both the legal work and the accounting work and other efforts to be able to stand up an investment vehicle. And once we had that set up, we reached out to people who we knew were interested in helping to find new ways to bring the country back together economically, but we're also investors to participate in that fund. And so we had over a dozen investors who are limited partners in the CORI Innovation Fund, put their money in. It's a traditional kind of venture fund where 2% of that money goes to the administrative costs of running it. And then if there's an upside, half of the upside goes to the person who's managing the fund, or half of the 20% that's called the carry goes to that. And then the rest of it comes back to our 501c3 nonprofit to help us support more communities in creating those kinds of tech economies across rural America. So it's a straightforward investment fund. We've invested in 9 really great rural companies that are doing incredible work. 3 of them are based in Vermont, 2 that are located in Springfield, and 1 that's located in Randolph. But we have communities as far away as Durango, Colorado, and in rural Wyoming that are all engaging in finding new solutions to market problems.
That is just, that sounds so exciting. It really does. Matt, we've got a caller, Michael from Waitsfield. Michael, do you have a question for Matt?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
This question concerns Waterbury. About a year ago, or maybe a little before that, I understood that a company that the state of Vermont does business with, a big software company, was taking space in Green Mountain Coffee's bacon plant, and was going to bring quite a few hundred big-paying jobs from $80,000 and up to Vermont. Since that time, I have not heard or read one iota about it. And in fact, at that time, I think the state was about to put some money incentive for them to come. It sounded like a complete done deal. And now I can't remember the name of the company, but you people in Waterbury for sure know the name of the company. They made such a big deal about it in all the newspapers and on the radio. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about and whatever happened to that?
I don't. Matt, do you know? But I am going to find out for sure. Do you have any idea?
No, I remember hearing something about it.
Yeah.
It's not in an area that we're really focused on. But I do think it comes back to an interesting piece, is that for a long time, the strategies of states and economic development was to try to throw as many tax incentives at large corporations to show up in our communities. And, you know, that used to be the way it worked early on. But it's really hard for a state like Vermont or rural places to be able to compete. And at the end of the day, if you've given away all of your tax incentives and all the resources that would come back to a community, you're not going to see the same kind of return. And then they could just pick up and leave for the next best offer that comes down the road. And so that's why we're so focused on entrepreneurs and supporting, you know, the next generation of dealer.coms or other kinds of companies that are homegrown or innovative individuals can just, you know, can take their idea and bring it to market. And for too long, there's been this notion nationally that that just can't happen in a rural place, that you can only do that in a city. It's just not true. And with technology advancing with cloud computing and broadband, it becomes more of an opportunity for rural places. So that's why we really emphasize supporting entrepreneurs that are building companies from the ground up that will be more connected to our state and our communities as they do that and can still, you know, create wealth and attract investment from all over the country and all over the world.
That's great. Do you, since you work with entrepreneurs, is that what the innovation hubs are that you were talking about that you were creating around rural America, a place for people to work, you provide equipment and services? Is that what the intent is of the hubs?
Exactly. It's to create places and spaces for folks to come together, either in a co-work environment to do the kinds of technology skill training that's important for a new workforce, or to provide, you know, low-risk space for entrepreneurs to work out of, and then to add a layer of programming to support those entrepreneurs, to be able to connect them to mentors, to be able to connect them to potential investors that are knowledgeable about their sector, and to help them understand how to do things like create a good term sheet for an early investment. That's not a simple process. And if we can help them get that without having to spend all of their limited resources on lawyers, that's a real advantage. It's a similar thing that folks, you know, that Dave Bradbury's been doing at VSET for a while, or folks at Hula are doing. We're just bringing that to more rural parts of the state and with their support, which is also the super exciting thing about Vermont, is that you get, you know, the state government helping support these efforts and leverage federal funding. You get the folks who have been successful in this area in Burlington knowing that that can happen throughout the state and doing it in just a really wonderful collaborative way.
That's great. Well, I had Dave Bradbury on the show a while ago, and I had visited him at where he works, and it's the excitement, the energy that's in that building by the entrepreneurs who are there. It's really, I'm excited for them and they're excited. It's a great atmosphere to work in and to get your creative juices going. So Matt, let me just quickly, we got about a minute or two. They must be thrilled to see you in these rural communities when you knock on their door.
Well, and we don't do a lot of door knocking, oddly. Hmm. They come to us. They raise their hand and say, yes, please. Sometimes it helps that we get funding to help support that work, and so we can do an RFP. Dan Smith was just a real visionary coming out of the early stages of COVID, saying, let's think about how do we build an economy for the future that can be more resilient and put up resources for communities in Vermont to say, we want to go down this path as well. And places like Randolph and Rutland and the Northeast Kingdom said, we're in. And so that once they see that we're serious about doing that and not just making it another thing they have to add on top, but getting the real resources to be able to execute on that vision, folks get really excited. But that leadership piece is absolutely key.
Absolutely.
Unless the community is excited about building a tech economy, it's not going to work, and that's okay. There are plenty of communities, both in Vermont and across the country, that are ready to bring a portion of their community's economy into a new era.
Thank you. Matt, it has, as usual, been an exciting conversation. I just can't thank you for all the work you're doing here in Vermont and all across the nation, actually. So, Matt Dunn, maybe we'll talk to you again soon because I've got many more questions for you. So thank you for all the work you're doing. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Hi there. This is Pat McDonald, back with you as your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Joining me for this half hour is Elliot Greenblatt, who is the Vermont coordinator for AARP and is focused on talking to us today on Vermont Fraud Watch Network. Little scams you got to look out for. Elliot, nice to meet you.
It's good to meet you as well.
Thank you. Well, you do an important job here. When I told my husband what we were going to talk about, he kind of perked up a little bit because sometimes you just don't know when an email comes or a phone call comes. I'm never quite sure until they usually ask for something like, you know, your social security number. Then I know it's time to hang up. But anyway, maybe we can go through some of these areas and you can tell our folks what to watch since the giving season is upon us. Could you talk a little bit about the charity scams that have come to your attention?
Well, certainly. Yeah, this is a time of year when the charities are out in numbers trying to get those donations that become so important to them. And between the fake charity scams and then there's some others that I'll talk about after we talk about the fake ones, it's hard to tell, you know, is this legitimate or is this something that really is not in the up and up. You know, charities raise money. They raise it for a variety of purposes. And one of the things that we have to watch out for is when a charity raises the money and then does not use that money for the intended purpose.
And can I stop you there and ask you, how can I check whether the person calling and says, you know, 180% of the money goes to the people we serve? How do you know that's true, and how can you check?
I think that's a great question. And there are some services that are easy to access. You do have to have web services at home or wherever you are. But there are three websites that I recommend. One is called Charity Navigator. The second one, GuideStar, and the third one is Give.org.
Huh.
These three organizations operate on actually donations, and they evaluate charities on two levels. The first level is how much of what they collect actually goes to the purpose that they state, and the second is how open are the books? Mm-hmm. Can you really do a deep dig to check that charity out? So these are three well-known sites. They are excellent for checking out those charities and
That's
making
great.
Sure they're legitimate.
Great information. Thank you very much, because they always say 80, 90%, very low overhead, blah, blah, but you never know. So that's good information. So go ahead, maybe you can talk a little bit more about the charity scams, because I'm one that says, if you can't send me something in the mail so I can hold it and read it, maybe not.
I think that's an excellent decision to make. Pledge cards are the best way to be able to verify that the charity is legitimate. If it is a scam, they're not going to send you anything, because odds are the scam originates outside the United States. So that's a quick red flag. No pledge card. Oh, just give us your credit card number.
Yeah, right.
you know, or do you happen to have any Apple gift cards? I don't know of any legitimate business or government agency that accepts gift cards in payment. So the minute somebody says gift card, that's a red flag. That's a blaring siren. You just have to be aware of that. Also, if it's an email, look at the spellings. Look at the grammar. If it isn't right, then it likely is also a scam.
Do you know what I've noticed? That the scammers use emails that are very close to the real thing, but maybe it's spelled a little differently. So when you do a quick look, you actually think it's legit. But when you look at each letter and how things are spelled in the email address itself, there's usually something wrong.
I get about 7 or 8 of these every day. One of them that I really like is one for Starbucks. I'm a coffee freak. And if it's Starbucks, that's one thing. But if the email address is Starbuck, then you're dealing with a scammer. You know, that's a very quick hint. The other thing is if it's coming from a generic email address like at gmail.com, at Hotmail, those are free accounts. The scammers like to use those. They don't have to pay. They don't like spending money to get money. So I think, you know, those are probably the, you know, the quick checks. The other is if there's an immediate request that you pay immediately, you know, this is urgent. We need your money right now so we can do it. We'll double the donation with one of our other, that's not going to happen. So this thing about immediate payment, forget that. As we said, you know, request that pledge card in the mail. Go to those websites I mentioned, Charity Navigator, GuideStar, Give.org. They do an excellent job of evaluating charities. You know, there's another kind of side note in the charities, and this I think a lot of people have gotten phone calls on, and that is a professional association in law enforcement or veterans that's trying to raise money. Quite often these are legitimate, but the problem is their overhead is extreme. For example, I received a call from one of these organizations, and there are two questions I always ask that they have to answer. The first one is, are you a paid professional fundraiser? Now, they have to answer that. Sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I'm working for this charity, and then you have to be insistent. If they say yes, the second question is, what percentage of the money that you raise goes to the charity for its purpose? Now, the organization that called me, the gentleman answered both of those questions, and the answer to the second one was 16%. That's 16% that goes to the organization for its work.
Wow.
The rest is kept by the fundraiser. So those are things, you know, you have to be aware of. You know, if you're pressured on the phone, hang up. That's the first thing. Now, if you don't, if you get it as an email, delete it. And never give credit card information or any personal information over the phone unless you can absolutely verify who you're talking to.
You would think that the legitimate nonprofits would be used to people being suspicious and would have something to put in the mail right away, just to alleviate your concerns. I got a call the other day, and in my house, we're very supportive of law enforcement and emergency services, et cetera, police. And he finally said he would send me something, and I'm waiting to see if that happens. But you would think that they would be ready to put it in the mail and get it out to you, because they must, it's not just me, they must run into all kinds of people who are a little skeptical.
I think there are a lot of skeptics out there. The pandemic has raised our awareness quite a bit. But, you know, one of the big problems that we have is it's the time of year when you're emotional. And emotional for a lot of different reasons. And you have a lot of anxiety and family getting together. And so with all of that and with the tendency to try and rush through things, we fall under what the criminals call the ether. We lose track of what we're actually doing until it's too late. So, for example, from that, the example you gave me, when you get that pledge card, if you get it, check out that charity. See what comes up from one of those evaluation services.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. And when you said 16% goes to the people they're supposed to be serving, that's I can't even believe that they admit it. That's outrageous.
Well, by law, they have to. And what happens quite often is the person calling you hangs up.
Oh, great. I have never had that. They hang in there because they think they're going to get you. Aaliyah, thanks. We've got two more areas to touch on, and the third one is of serious interest to me, the Medicare Advantage plans. So maybe we could talk about the utility company threats and then spend the rest of the time talking about Medicare.
Okay. I think, you know, the utility company threat is something that we can deal with very, very quickly. People report that they have received calls from, let's say, Green Mountain Power, threatening to terminate service immediately unless, and the unless is immediate payment, often via gift card or a Zelle or a Venmo transfer. And the simple thing to know is it's illegal for utility companies to do this. They will not say, you know, your service is going to be cut off tonight at midnight. You better pay now. They have to notify in writing. The other thing is businesses like Green Mountain Power or any other utility, Comcast, for example, they don't accept gift cards. They don't accept Zelle or Venmo or cryptocurrency. So the minute those things come into the conversation, it's a scam. The things to do, one, don't give any personal information and report this with as much detail as you can to your utility company.
That's great advice. And that's interesting if they, And, of course, cryptocurrency, I've heard of it, but I have no clue. So they wouldn't get it from me. But I like in the notes you gave me, I love it. Steps to take. First one in large letters, hang up. That sounds to me to be the best advice. Just hang up. Make them go away. And then report it. I think that's important. There's one now out. I think it's the IRS. And the guy says the IRS does not call and make threats on the phone. They may write you, but
right. They will not send you an email with a form to fill out.
Right.
They don't do that. You will receive a letter in the mail, and it will give you a chance to respond rather than if you don't pay, the sheriff will be coming to arrest you.
Right, exactly. It's a real fear, isn't it? And when you're elderly, I guess, and maybe living alone, you really take all that to heart because you want to stay where you are and live your life in your home. So that's pretty scary stuff. So now I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Before we, you know, there's this feeling that, you know, the best victim out there is an elderly woman living alone on a hillside in Warren. That, you know, that is not the typical target. The target of choice is actually a well-educated male, usually with advanced degree, and in the age range of about 50 to 65. The other thing, and the reason why, that's where success is. The people in our society who typically have made it are people in that age bracket, and it's usually men, and quite often they have this sense that they're not where they want to be. So they make some poor decisions. The other quick comment is that the most vulnerable age group in American society is between 25 and 45 years of age.
Both those statistics are stunning. The age and the focus on the male, that just surprises me. I was with the older lady by themselves in the middle of nowhere. That was what I was thinking, and you have surprised me. Elliot, we've got a caller, Rich from Starksboro. Rich, go ahead.
Hi, Elliot. Thank you for your monthly show. I think it's monthly. I got a question about a call I keep receiving on, they leave a voicemail. The call comes from any number all over the country. I got at least one from Vermont, and the message, you know, comes up with a, you know, a non-human voice that said, I didn't detect any input. Please press a number. It's a different number every time, but all these different numbers have the same message. And I think it's somebody faking to do a second level authorization when you're logging in, where you get a 6-digit number after you put your password to log into something. They're trying to fake you out. But I was wondering if you got any thoughts on it.
You know, this whole thing with telephone calls is kind of interesting, because these calls are basically free of charge. They're made using computers. The more successful scammers will temper their messages and email their phone numbers to whatever place you live. So it's not unusual to get 802s, and sometimes even 802s with your local calling number. The minute you get those, hang up. There's literally nothing we can do to stop them, and they are more annoyance calls than anything else. If you know people do provide any information, they should immediately hang up and then contact an organization like CODE, the Community of Vermont Elders, or even AARP, and say, look, I think I made a mistake. What should I do?
Hmm. Interesting. That's a great question, Rich. Thank you very much. You got to be very careful, don't you, Elliot? Let's spend the rest of the time talking about my favorite thing, Medicare Advantage plans. I have gotten more mailers from Medicare. Could you talk about what's for real and what to think twice about?
Okay, there are a lot of mass-marketed, legitimate plans out there. And obviously, it's a high-stakes game, so the HMOs, the Blue Crosses of the world, the United Healthcare, they want to get you. And they want to get you signed up so that they end up with the contract for your medical care. These are legitimate. The other ones, the scams, generally don't send out the mailers. Again, Congress, the criminals don't like to spend money. And those things cost a lot. And for the mass marketers, they realize that, yeah, we've got to spend a lot of money doing this, but we're going to be able to score a lot better if we use the mailers, if we use the emails. It is illegal, though, for them to call you directly. They can do these mass marketing things, which is where you're going to see the big names, as I mentioned, the Blue Crosses and Blue Vermont Advantage and United Healthcare. Those companies are out there, and they're the ones with the money to do it. It's the other ones that you have to be more careful about. There is a caveat, and that is, once you respond or reply to one of these ads, and that includes the ones you see that are pitched by celebrities on TV, that means you have established a relationship with them, and now the gloves are off. They can call you. They can email you personally. They can even show up at your doorstep. They're prohibited from doing a lot of those things if you don't have a relationship with them. But a simple phone call to them ends up becoming a nightmare. So if it's coming as a robocall, hang up. If you see this ad on TV and it looks really good, don't fall for it. There is something you can do that I think is really helpful. And that is if you go to the website Medicare.gov, again, Medicare.gov, you can pull up comparative plan information. And all of the plans available in Vermont appear under the Vermont tab. And it'll ask you things like, type in the prescriptions you take. And then it'll give you the costs, all the costs, not just, you're going to get free dental care, you're going to get free eyeglasses. Nah, it's not going to just give you the free stuff. It'll also show you this is what it costs. So that's important.
That's great. I didn't know that. That's wonderful. Elliot, I've got a caller on the phone. We've only got about 2 minutes. So Gail from Calais, okay. Could you ask Elliot your question?
That's okay. Hi, good morning. You're talking about Advantage Care?
Yep.
Okay,
yes.
You're aware of my situation. I just want to let people know that when they say that Advantage Care is the same as Medicare, it is not. Long story short, when I was transferred to rehab, I found out that I did not have Medicare, and it ended up costing me $10,000.
And she's not kidding.
Yeah. You have to look at the fine print. That's why I recommend the Medicare.gov website, because it will give you that information, and it will also put you through into what the restrictions or prior approvals are that can be critical to whether or not the particular item is covered. So I understand that fully. There are ways, before you sign on the dotted line, we're in open enrollment right now, so before you change plans or go into an Advantage plan or any other medical supplemental plan for Medicare, look at the details. See what it will actually cost. And if you have a question, you can put that question to Medicare. I'll mention COVE, Community of Vermont Elders, again. They have a program called SMP, or Senior Medical Medicare Patrol, and the number for that is 888-865-2683.
Thank you, Elliot. That's all of this is such great information. And I love the note you gave me, and everybody should pay attention. If it's too good to be true, it is likely a scam. And we will leave you with that. We'll talk to Elliot next week. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald back with you with Vermont Viewpoint. My guest this morning is someone I've known for quite a while, Amy. Her name is Amy White, who's vice president of the M&T Bank in Barrie and a whole bunch of other places. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pat. It's great to be here.
It's our first time on radio, so we're going to... You'll be good. Not to worry.
This is different. This is like a time warp. It's like I'm going back in a museum with all the posters.
It's cozy. I had three people in here one day doing a show, and it was a little too cozy, actually.
Yeah.
But Amy actually yelled at me the other day. I called her and asked her on the show because the bank is holding a holiday card challenge for our military personnel, and I wanted to bring that to your attention. But I also wanted to talk about M&T Bank, because I said to her, I went to Barry, and next thing I know, there's signs, and she says, where have you been? I thought I'm up on this stuff, Amy.
I know. Well, you know, your listeners and our customers, they may see the different brand, but guess what? It's all us. Yes. We're still there. Yeah. It's the same faces, the same what I like about M&T, it's the focus in community. In fact, we're charged as employees to really go out and work in the community, right. Be a volunteer. We're actually paid to do that.
That's great.
So it's exciting and it's a change, but it's been great. Thank I'm excited you. For what's coming down the road for our customers and our employees. There's lots of opportunities.
Now they said something that while you're part of M&T Bank, are you still going to be referred to as People's United Division, so that identity will remain?
No, that was during our merger. It took a little longer than should have, part because of the COVID.
Right.
So we were kind of in a transition of both.
Okay.
So now, no, we are M&T Bank.
Which stands for?
Manufacturers and Traders, and their corporate headquarters is in Buffalo, New York.
That's great. And they are not a small bank.
Well, both businesses, when it was People's United and M&T, were both considered in the industry as small community banks. We've merged together.
Right.
We bring the best of the best. And what I like, it's that community focus. We're still involved.
That's great.
That's what we want to be. That's what we're growing to be.
Well, I know for sure you're involved. I think when I was working part-time for Barry City, I think that's where we first met. Must have been a community meeting or something way back when.
Yeah, it was probably with the Barry Partnership.
Yep, exactly. Right?
Yes.
And you're also, Amy and I are in the USS Vermont Support Group. And you've been there much longer than I have, and I thank you for that.
Yeah, I was involved in that. We actually have a submarine that's named after Vermont. And I got involved when I heard about a commissioning. I thought, this is grand. I want to know more. So we got through the commissioning again through the COVID. But now we've got a group, and our charge is this is what I like. We want the sailors on that boat to know what it is to be Vermont and the Vermonters.
Right.
And we want Vermonters to know about our boat and the sailors. So we've been bringing them up here. They've been in parades. We've had them at the State House. They had a meeting with the governor. We've had them all through. They've been to Pulteney in a parade. And just meeting people in Vermont and learning about what we have to offer as our little state.
You know, they're going to have a tour of the submarine on they call it Vermont Day. And apparently they have rooms named after things in Vermont. So,
I had an opportunity to tour the boat. And Gary Freymeyer, who's our chair of the Vermont Support Group, he has made sure there are posters, there are stickers, they have a Burton snowboard down on their boat. different sections of the boat are named after different Vermont ski areas. It's really
fun. That's cool. That's
great. You know, they're really learning about us.
And there used to be, I don't know if it's still true, first of all, the sailors have to volunteer to serve on a submarine. They're not just identified and go, hey, you're serving.
Yeah.
They have to volunteer. And there are two Vermonters on the boat.
Yes, there were.
Who we met here in Vermont, which was great.
Yeah, they actually came to a barbecue that we had, and so it was nice to meet them. I don't know if they're still on the boat or not.
Yeah.
That I don't know. But getting back to the Vermont Days, that's the big charge. We're hoping this spring we want to have Vermonters come down to Groton, and you'll actually be able to go on a tour of the boat.
I'm psyched about that because WCAX, Darren Perrin went on it when it was first, I think, the christening, and they had to hide all the equipment in the main deck, whatever it's called, the main office, so that he wouldn't take pictures of the secret
equipment. No photography.
Yeah, but apparently now, because it's been around for a while, that it'll be open and we'll be able to see everything. So very excited. Anyway, I've neglected to ask one thing about M&T. You mentioned there'll be more services coming, different types of services.
Things will expand, which is banking. We've got the loans. We're working, businesses, small businesses, big businesses. That's an area. We've got the loans. We've got the ATMs. But it's the community focus that's the piece.
Great.
That's the piece that makes us different.
That's great. Well, you can't go wrong with manufacturers and traders, right? They're the heart of Vermont and blue collar. We love it. So that's great. Anyway, but they have 38 branches here in Vermont.
Yeah.
I want to know where I have been, Amy.
We're in 34 cities. We're all the way up into St. Albans, Newport, Ludlow, all the way down in Brattleboro. We cover the whole state.
Well, M&T, welcome to Vermont.
Yeah, that's great. Yes.
And they're big mostly in New England, I think, New York and Connecticut and all that whole area.
They cover. So now with the merger, we were more on the east side, being their corporate headquarters is in Buffalo, New York. Of course, they've got New York. But they go all the way from Maine now to Washington, D.C.
Right.
So we're in Virginia, West Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania.
That's great.
It's been exciting. And the co-workers, the other team members in the other seats have been so helpful, so giving, and so supportive. It's been great.
And that's great that they've kept everybody. Good for them.
Oh, yeah.
That would make a big difference from a community perspective.
Very supportive of us and very welcoming and so happy to have us. Yeah. That's the feeling.
People really like to walk into a branch and say, hi, Amy, hi. I worked at the Merchants Bank for a lot of years, and they just like it. I can see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they want to feel like somebody is looking after them personally.
Exactly. Yeah. And now that we're through this COVID, because for a long time, none of us were allowed to go out to visit.
Because of COVID.
It was COVID. You didn't want to. So that's opened up. So I'm excited.
That's great.
Good things are coming down the pike.
Excellent. Good for you. Good spokesman. That's a great, it looks like a really great entity.
It is.
All right. So let's go back to the USS Vermont support. And could you talk about what your bank is doing and encouraging us to do?
So this is a challenge that came out, and it's a little on the end of it, but I'm hoping we've been challenged to collect holiday cards for our military. What we're doing is if you know any M&T Bank employee, any branch, just bring in a holiday card. We're calling it holiday more to keep – we're sensitive to the diversity in religions. And so just name – maybe your city and state, just your first name, a little bit, happy holidays, thinking of you, dear warrior, and we're going to make sure they will be in their hands in time for the holiday season. We want all our deployed military to have a greeting card from us here in Vermont. The branches that are participating in this are all of Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire. And we have a connection in New Hampshire. We're taking care of all of the cost of getting these cards to them. Just bring a card. Doesn't have to be in an envelope. No stamps, no postage. We're going to take care of the rest.
And there is time. The deadline is November 14th.
Yes.
But you've got a few days if you're in Barry or anywhere where there's an M&T bank, just grab a card, write a nice thought, because I would bet every soldier, especially overseas, would love to hear from Pat from Berlin.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Just a little, here I'm from Vermont. Wow, Vermont.
Cool.
We were thinking of them.
Let's go Vermont. That's great. Well, they seem to be, as you said, they're very active in the community, and I'm really looking forward to meeting other folks from M&T, which are you guys from people,
we're 34 cities across the state.
That's great. And those are, when you go into Barry, the M&T just stands right.
Yeah, that green really pops.
Yeah, it's like, where did this come from?
Yeah, I know. I had a customer that was a little confused about where we were when the sign went to green. But we're on the inside, it's still us.
It's the same.
We're here.
You can walk in and say, hi, Amy.
You certainly can.
And what do you do at the bank? What is your assigned duties?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. I'm the branch manager, so that involves overseeing
everything.
The branch.
Duties as assigned, as we say.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Occasionally, it might. might include a washing a window. It's a little bit, you know, it takes it as it comes. I've got a great team. They're dynamic and they're on board and they do a wonderful job.
That's great.
In fact, a lot of my customers, they bypass me now. They go to the front line.
As it should be, right?
Yeah,
they know your people. That's great. Yeah, it's a nice location too. It's right near,
Shopping right on Granite Center, Street.
Granite Street.
Right on the corner. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's going great.
Amy and I in the break were talking about all the things that M&T has been involved in. And this has been a relatively short. When was the merger did actually took place?
It just actually April, right? Finalized on September 2nd, Labor Day weekend.
Oh.
That's when everything converted our systems. But it'd been months prior.
Right.
We were running both simultaneous.
Well, maybe not that COVID was a good thing by any stretch, but maybe give you a little time to do it more smoothly, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely.
It was like, thank God it's over.
Yes, we were all so anxious to get to M&T and just to be one
good.
M&T. That's
exactly.
Who we are.
Well, tell me a couple of the things that that they've been involved in, which are great.
M&T, we sponsored the city marathon in Burlington.
Right.
M&T was the sponsor. We've also just sponsored the Athena Award. Betsy Bishop of the Vermont Chamber was the recipient. Congratulations,
That's the
Betsy.
Central Vermont Chamber.
The Central Vermont Chamber. Betsy is with the Vermont Chamber.
Right.
She's president of the Vermont Chamber. But Central Vermont Chamber of Commerce is the one that puts on the annual Athena Award, which is a national organization recognizing dynamic women in the state for Vermont.
Right.
And Betsy was the recipient this
year. Well, she's certainly been a contributor to this state for a lot of years.
She has been
working in state government, and now at the Central Vermont Chamber.
What's
the state chamber?
The state chamber.
Done a great
Vermont
job.
Chamber.
Great job.
Yeah, she
and
has.
Tell me about
so,
the family center.
Yeah,
that's
the family
hysterical.
Center. So we were a sponsor for Bare Bottoms for Babies Diapers Drive. And I just love the name.
That's cool.
Bare Bottom Babies.
Yeah. Now, the family center, is that the one in Montpelier?
Right in Berlin.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So they do a lot for the families that need, you know, and the diaper drive, I was there with a chamber mixer, and they were showing us the facilities and the education piece they have, not only for the parents, but also for the children and the needs of these people. Diapers are expensive. And so it was certainly there wasn't a question with M&T Bank.
That's
I just
great.
Mentioned it, and yes, we'll do
Excellent.
It.
Excellent.
Yes,
Excellent.
It makes sense. So it's everything I've asked for. It's been great with M&T.
And for you, is that a call to Buffalo or a call to?
We have local representation in Vermont. Yes, yes.
Good. So then they really do
but
know.
But we're supported. We're supported by M&T.
Right.
So it's been great.
That's great. Well, I'm just wondering if you were calling people who know Vermont, and if they are here locally, they would understand the importance of getting involved in all. Especially the city marathon. You want to talk about exposure.
Yes. Oh, and we had runners from all over the United.
Oh, good for them.
From M&T, from all over, and was in the marathon.
We'll expect to see at the Corporate Cup Challenge.
I'm not running.
You know what you said? Get me so upset. I would walk. And on our way on the walk, we would go over the bridge by the old thrush and the runners would be coming back. And I go, please, people, give me a break. I'm just starting. I'm just walking. I'm a third of the way walking and they are already running back. I was like so depressed. It's ridiculous. But anyway, but we finished. I always figured that was a good thing.
Congratulations.
Not to die while walking.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So we also, as I mentioned, Amy and I are on the USS Vermont Support Group. They have some of the meetings that they've had here with the sailors have been so moving to me to hear the leadership of the submarine, to hear from them, to hear their passion, and to talk to the sailors individually one-on-one. And I don't know how many of you old-timers, that's me, know Al Perry. He was a representative from the Northeast Kingdom. His family, I'm going to get this wrong, and Gary Freimeyer is going to call me up and yell at me. I think it's 140 years of combined service in the Perry family.
I believe you're correct.
Is that right? I mean, that's staggering. Everybody in that family has somewhere or other been involved in the Navy and serving at fairly high in positions, because Al was a commander, I believe. Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing the love and the dedication that they have for this country and for the Navy. But we were at a ceremony in Groton that was, I went with a friend of mine, and they actually did this, when they do the rifle gun salute, they did it with cannons. It was so amazing. It was just, you could feel it in your chest. It was, it's got me started crying. And then I'm just going to talk one more thing and then I'll turn it over to Amy. They had the 100 sailors were standing behind us at attention with their white uniforms on. Oh. And, Gloria Rodriguez, who was the ship sponsor, she said to them, and I'm not going to be able to quote her exactly, make this ship come to life. And the, Vermont military band was there and they played the military song, and all the sailors ran through the group over the plank onto the ship itself and stood at attention. I was crying. The guy who was with me kept backing off because he's like, what is wrong with you? But I was so emotional with this making the ship come, because obviously it's a ship, but it's the sailors that make it come to life.
It does. And, you know, I just, the different events that I've been with the sailors here in Vermont and talking with people, the residents, the, you know, the population here in Vermont, there's a lot of pride.
Yeah.
This is Vermont USS 792 submarine.
Yep.
This is us, that we're a part of this. And the sailors come from all over the United States. And, you know, a lot were from the South and they were coming up. We were taking them to the Cabot Creamery, to Cold Hollow, and
well, they saw a baseball game
at the
Field of Montpelier.
And it's been great interaction.
Yeah,
yeah.
And they're very appreciative too. You give them one little thing, and you just feel overwhelmed by their gratitude. It's really amazing.
Here we're part of the support group. Whenever a new sailor comes onto the boat, they each received a sunshine bag, which has information about Vermont, but also a little bit of maple syrup and some cheese, Cabot cheese, different things, coupons and stuff and information. And that's been so well received.
Yeah.
In fact, Gary Freymeyer, the chair of our group, last year at Christmas time, he went down and he was Santa and he brought maple popcorn.
Oh, get out.
Down, yes, from Vermont.
Yep.
And gave them to the children.
Well, and you've mentioned a couple of firms here in Vermont who are constantly, constantly giving. Cabot,
yes.
And I mean, there's just so many of them. I'd hate to start listing them, but
I know,
we live in a very generous state. And I know even after COVID and after the things where people needed help, they just stepped up.
Yeah.
So we are very fortunate to live in this very giving state.
We are. We are. We're lucky to be here.
Yeah. That's great. So, new customers coming to M&T?
Yeah.
Come on down.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. Looking, we're there. I just want to just reiterate the challenge, holiday cards for our military challenge. So please reach out to any M&T branch. Bring your holiday card. We'll take care of the rest of it.
We want to win the challenge by branch. Is it a, how many cards can you?
I might have a little bit of a desire to have the
beat
most
them out.
Cards.
All right, people, you've heard the challenge. Yeah. I'm going to go bring a card down there. If I had gotten my act together, I could have done it right now, but no. But it's right down the street. So go to a local M&T bank, bring a card. I cannot tell you, I just can't tell you how they would appreciate this.
It does. I've talked with a lot of military, and that card coming in, it just it's a delight.
Yeah. Right, you know? Especially with some of the places our men and women are serving now.
Yeah.
They need a little touch of home.
Exactly.
That's great.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Amy. Come down to the M&T Bank. Sign up if you don't have
an
account.
Yeah, come in and say hi.
Yeah, say hi. And Amy will tell you all about the services.
Yes, definitely.
That's great. Very convenient. And that's it for us. We are going to take a break, and WDEV will continue. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.